Continuing in the book of Genesis. And I think we left off, was it Genesis 28 or 29? Let's see, let me find my notes here. Yes, I believe it's Genesis 29 is where we would start at today. Before we go into that, though, just want to remind everyone the time of the year that we're in two perspectives. One, it seemed like the winter months seem to always be a time of a lot of trial for God's people. In the years I've been in the church, it seems invariably right around the time we get to December and January, trials seem to pick up within the churches of God, and then it just peaks as we get close to Passover. And it's that way almost every year. So it's a time for us to really pray fervently, all of us pray fervently for each other, and continue that unceasing prayer for one another to help us to make it through this time. And there's no doubt that Satan the devil would like to discourage us even further because of some of the things we've gone through as a church. And he would like to use that to even all the more try to make us give up. But I hope nobody does that. Don't give up. We'll read more about that in a moment when we look at Jacob. You know, to not give up and to hang on, because the reward in the end is going to be great. And I tell you something, I am convinced in my mind that we would not be going through all these troubles if we weren't a threat. We're a threat. And I believe that. We're a threat to the enemy. And one reason for that, when I look at this little group here, I see each individual here is dedicated to seeking the will of God. And I tell you something, you can have a small group that's dedicated to seeking the will of God. And when God chooses to do so, he can do mighty things through that group of people. And he will. Because I think he's preparing you for something. Now, what specifically, I don't know. I can't, you know, I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you specifically. But there's no doubt in my mind that he is. And ultimately, he's going to bring you to the fore. And it seems like whenever we get a little closer, then something happens. And as we'll see as we go through a little bit with the story of Jacob, we'll see how that kind of works a little bit. And sometimes you have to go through a few things in order to really reach that defining moment with God. That defining moment with him. And as you go through the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you see that. At least I hope you do. I hope I can help you see it. But you see that. It's there. That lesson is there over and over again. And these were righteous men who loved God, but we see a process that they had to go through. It wasn't like they were perfect instantly or just full of faith all at once. They went through a process of growth and of God dealing with them and working with them. They made mistakes. They sinned. Yes, that's right. These righteous men sinned. And women. Because there were some women there too. And they sinned too. And yet, even in the midst of their failures, their trials, their difficulties, and all that they went through, God was still with them. And that's one of the things so marvelous to me as I read this and I look through it, it's so encouraging, because you see God was still with them. And he still loved them. And he still helped them. And he still blessed them. Even in the midst of why they were making mistakes, he was blessing them. Which is really marvelous. It goes to show how little we know about our God. And Satan would like us to doubt him and to have this here false Protestant concept of God. Because the Protestant concept of God is one of a God that is, you know, ready to just jump on you and pounce on you and do you in a second if you mess up. But God is not like that. He's long-suffering. Long-suffering. And when he puts his hand and chooses someone, when he chooses you and calls you, he commits himself in covenant relationship with you. And once he's made that commitment and covenant relationship with you, he does not give up on you. He doesn't do it. He sticks with you through thick and thin. Now, sometimes when we're going through trials, you know, the trials make us feel like that's not the case. And we start, you know, and I've done it many times too, we start saying things like, "Where are you, Lord? Where are you?" But remember the example that God showed to Jacob. Here this man was running, fleeing for his life from his brother, and God caused him to have the dream of the staircase to let him know how close he was. You know, Jacob forgot that almost immediately. He really did. As we see the story, as we get to chapter 29, he leaves. He has the dream. He makes the vow with God. You know, he's encouraged at that moment. Then he goes and he meets Laban and Rachel and Leah. And he makes his first mistake shortly after arriving. He gets tricked by his uncle. Now, God allowed this little test for Jacob, this trickery that came from his uncle. You know, he had to teach him a few lessons because Jacob had used a little trickery himself, hadn't he? So now it's kind of like paybacks. You know, teach him how that felt. So he gets tricked. But also, it was a test of his faith, too, at the same time. Because he could have made a choice in the midst of this situation. He could have, but he didn't. You know the story. He goes there, and of course, he meets Laban, and he meets Rachel at the well, and she's very beautiful. Scripture says that she, that Leah was soft-eyed or tender-eyed, and I'm not quite sure of the Hebrew in that as I went into it, and some scholars feel that she was weak, and her eyes kind of reveal sort of a weakness of appearance. I don't know if that's what it really meant or not. Others feel that it was tender-eyed, that she had nice eyes. You know, so I'm not sure which one applied. But on the case of Rachel, it's very, very clear and specific as to the way she looked. It said that she was beautiful in shape and appearance. What we men today would say, stacked. She was beautiful in every respect and caught Jacob's eye instantly. And that was it. He said he wanted Rachel. And he worked for her, made as they did in those days, you know, because that's the way marriage contracts were arranged. You would either have to have a dowry to give the father, parents, so much money because they're losing labor from their family. So you're restoring the labor by giving them some material good or possession because of loss of labor. That's the way things worked in those societies. But Jacob didn't have a dowry because, you know, he had to flee in a hurry and he didn't have anything. So he had to work for Rachel. And he worked 7 years. And Scripture says it was just as a day to him. It was just as a day. He worked 7 years for Rachel. Every time she passed by and saw her, he worked harder. You know, he was determined he was going to have that woman. It was 7 years. And then after 7 years, what happened? You know the story, of course. I'm just, you know, just summarizing it. And anyway, what happened? Laban tricked him on the day of his wedding, you know, because they wore the veils and all the other stuff, you know, back then. And there was a lot of partying going on, a lot of drinking. And, you know, obviously Jacob got a little bit tanked. And then Laban sent his firstborn daughter, Leah, into the tent to be with Jacob. And he, as the King James English says, laid with her, had relations with her that evening, that night. Didn't know it was Leah. Woke up the next morning and now he's sober. And he looks over and it wasn't who he thought it was. Well, he had a choice right then and there, actually. He had a choice because that was not a binding contract. He was tricked. And he didn't have to go along with it. But now, of course, he might have had some difficulty to face with Laban because in those societies, back in those days, when you broke a contract, they could kill you. See, that's the way they did business back then. So Laban told him, well, you know, according to our customs, the firstborn, my firstborn daughter has to go first. So we got to take her. And so you were with her last night. You know, that's it. Now, he could have trusted God, couldn't he? Because God could have got him out of that. But already he made a mistake. So he, instead of turning to God and saying, Lord, deliver me from this. And, you know, you know who I really wanted? Nope. He went ahead and he went along with the contract. Laban said, work for me 7 more years and I'll give you Rachel. And his lust got the better of him. And so he said, okay. He worked 7 more years. And then this started something that actually became a problem for that family that exists to this very day. A competition that begins to develop because of all these different children from different wives, and even as you go down the line, concubines that were also involved with different conflicting traits. And it became a problem that exists even to this day among the children of Israel. They don't know it, but it is there. And Jacob could have avoided that, but you see, God allowed it to happen. He allowed him to make these choices, to make these decisions, which is another lesson in Genesis that's very powerful, because on the one hand, you see God in his sovereign hand working out his plan, but on the other hand, allowing free moral agency and free choices being made. And on the other hand, utilizing even the free choices to still work out his plan. Showing you the brilliance, the genius of God, of his ability to be able to do something like that and still allow you to have this freedom. Because he didn't make that choice for Jacob to marry Leah. Jacob made the choice. He caved in to his father-in-law. And so we get to chapter 29, and I call it the battle between the wives. I actually had another name for it, but I thought I'd be a little nicer and change it. But but the battle between the wives that takes place here. Because each of them now begin to battle for Jacob's affection, showing you right there, you know, the problem with having two wives. It's tough enough with one. But anyway, here he is, he's dealing with two. And then later on, he's even got the concubines coming into play here. And poor Jacob, this poor guy, as you will see, he just started having trouble here. Lots of trouble. But let's start off in chapter 29 and see what happened here. Then Jacob went on his journey and he came to the land of the people of the east. And we already covered most of this, so I'm going to drop all the way down to, where the first conception takes place, because I've already given you a summary. It says here, verse 31, and this is a key verse here. I'll show you how God works. And when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, or that word actually should be loved less. When Leah was loved less, he opened her womb, but Rachel's was bare. Why did God do that? Why did God do that? I've already given you the answer in the things I said a moment ago. Why did God do that? Can anyone tell me? Because Leah was Jacob's legal wife. See, he loved her less. It was Rachel whom he originally wanted, remember? But Leah was the one he married first. And he didn't really have to, but once he accepted the terms that Laban laid down, it made the contract binding. That was now his legal wife. Rachel was in addition to that, and it was not the ideal situation as God had originally set marriage to be with Adam and Eve, and as Christ came along later on and reiterated the way marriage was supposed to be. So Leah was really now Jacob's legal wife, but see, Jacob didn't love her like he loved Rachel. But God caused Leah to give forth the firstborn. He caused that to happen. And that was his way of trying to, you know, like, make Jacob think too as well. You know, you got yourself in this mess. Now, I'm going to bless her. The firstborn. Your firstborn is going to come from her. And not only did the firstborn come from her, as you will read down later on, even the one through whom Christ came through Leah, Judah. The one that Christ came from Leah. She was really the legal wife. You read later on, in fact, in Genesis when Rachel is having her second child and dies, which was Benjamin, and Jacob buried her in some obscure place. But when Jacob was in Egypt and was about to die and was talking to his son Joseph, he told him where to bury him. It was the same place where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Leah were buried. Told him to bury, he had buried Leah there, and to bury him there with Leah. Kind of interesting. He recognized that Leah was his legal wife. And she was buried in the sacred tomb, as you, if I might call it that, where the other patriarchs and their wives were. But Rachel was not. Yes.
I was thinking of Abraham told a servant, don't let Isaac go back. He wouldn't let Isaac go back.
Right.
But Isaac told, let Jacob go back. And it maybe, if he would have worked it out like Abraham, Jacob would have had Leah, would have been into the story.
That's possibly. I thought about that too, I didn't arrive at a conclusion either way. I don't know what was going on with Isaac's mind in letting Jacob or even sending him back, whereas Abraham would not let Isaac go back. So I thought about that too. That was a kind of wondered a little bit about that, whether or not Isaac was using good judgment in doing that or not, because Abraham wouldn't allow it. And even God even told Abraham, don't even let them, you know, go back. So Isaac kind of went contrary to that judgment. And maybe also that might have played in, like you said, to the complications that took place with Jacob. That if he had stayed there, God would have supplied. But again, we're talking about a process of growth and faith for all of them. And there are times for all of us when our faith is not what it should be. But you know the wonderful thing about it? God does not forsake us. He does not forsake us. You know, God does not require perfect faith for Him to intervene in your behalf. I used to think when I was, newly begotten Christian, that I used to really worry about my prayers getting answered because I was new and my faith was very weak. And I used to really worry about my prayers being answered because I knew I didn't have very much faith at that point. I knew that. And yet, I remember some of the most dramatic answers to prayers that I got back in those days. Dramatic answers to prayer. I remember once I needed some money. I was broke and needed some money, and I asked God for a specific amount of money. I mean by the amount that I needed. And I said, Lord, I'm desperate here. I need this money. And it was like a Friday evening. I went on a fast that evening. And I think it was that Saturday afternoon, my mother called me, told me that there was an envelope there at the house. Someone had put in the mailbox at her house. On that same day, I wasn't even off the fast yet. Hadn't even come off of it yet. And my mother told me there's an envelope in there. And I said, well, what's in there? So she opened it up and she read. It was a little short note. And it said, from a concerned member with love. That's all. With this cash in the envelope. And it was the exact amount that I asked for. Now, I don't think I had been baptized, not even a year, I think. It might have been 6 months or something. I can't remember the exact length of time now, but it was a very short period of time. And that prayer was answered, just like that. And there were others that were answered like that. And I was not a walking, spiritual giant of faith. I just simply was not. I was new to the faith, and there was a lot of doubt and insecurities that were there. And yet, God still was merciful to me in answering various different prayers. I had another situation in which I prayed and asked for God to deliver me from a job that I was in. I need to find another job. And this, I hope, might be encouraging those of you looking for a job. And I said, Father, I need another job. I was being persecuted literally on the job I was on. I was, you know, kind of unwise in those days, you know, about expression of my faith to a certain extent. I created some enemies on the job. I think I mentioned a story once before how they wanted to beat me up after work. And I confronted them boldly in the office. I went to the back of the office and stood there in the back and confronted the entire group of them and began to tell them about how simple they were and so forth. You know, it wasn't exactly a wise thing to do. And then I walked up to the guy who was the main ring leader, who was suggesting to the others about getting me out to work and beating me up. And I stood over him and said, well, now I'm here now. You can beat me up now. So I had a combination of righteousness and carnality. I was still there. So he didn't do anything, but I left work early. So they couldn't get me after work. Well, I prayed and asked God. I said, look, I need to find a job. I don't have the time to take off to look for one right now. I said, but I need another job. I got to get out of here. And one day I came into the office and there was some guy from Lansing visiting my boss, who was a friend of my boss, who was just sitting there talking to him, saying they had this new position open up with the state of Michigan up in Lansing, and they were looking for new people to put in the position, but they couldn't find anybody qualified. So my boss recommended me, had me come in and meet these guys. And I sat down and talked with them. And they said, well, you know, they might contact me at some point later on. But they left, and I didn't hear any more from them. Well, I found out later what happened. About a couple months went by. They looked all over the place to find someone to fill the position, and they couldn't. The position required somebody that had a bachelor's degree, which I did not have. I didn't have a bachelor's degree. But those people that they interviewed that did have the degrees felt that that particular job wasn't paying enough or whatever it might be, or overqualified or whatever, but they wouldn't take the job. Well, they came back and got me. Called me one day, asked me to come to an interview in Lansing. I went up there, walked into this business, this 14-story building, and it was up on like the 10th, 12th floor, whatever it was, and I went into this big office of the guy who's over the health department. And went in there, and they were interviewing me, and it was almost like I had the job right then and there. I wasn't sure, but they took me back to my office, showed me where my office was going to be. This was a job for someone with a bachelor's degree and 5 years of experience in that position. I had neither. I had neither one of those things. Well, I got hired. Started work about a couple weeks later after that, and the director of the personnel office came up to my office to see me. Because somehow they had went over the head of the personnel director to put me in a position. That's what they did. And he was offended. So I had another trial almost immediately. So then he was offended. He came to my office and he said, how did you get this job? And I said, I don't know. You know? He says, you don't have a bachelor's degree, do you? I said, no. He said, how much education do you have? I said, well, a couple of semesters of college. That was it. That's all I had. I had no more than that. And he had a hard time dealing with that for a while. But I got that job. And I knew it was God to intervene. Did I have great faith at the time? No, because it was almost like a surprise when it happened. It was almost like a surprise. But God is with us. He really is with us. And he's able to open up doors when you least expect it. I've had it happen more than one time. I've had it happen. And I've learned to just trust in it now. Now I trust in it. Let's go back to our story with Jacob here. And we were in this last verse. So Leah was hated. And verse 32, and Leah conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Reuben. For she said, surely the Lord has looked upon my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. You see what's going on here? They're vying for their husband's love and attention and commitment. And that's almost impossible with two women in the household. That just can't work. But And this is also a tremendous lesson that God is allowing here to be written to that particular point. And Jacob had to learn this lesson. There were a lot of things that they were ignorant of back in those days and didn't know. And God allowed them to learn through these experiences this way. And he's allowing this to happen with Jacob. But before I go on to any more to children, I'll just summarize. She had four children, one after the other. Rachel was barren and couldn't have any children. So now Rachel, in order to compete, she was afraid that Leah would get all of Jacob's attention. So she goes and gets one of her maid servants, which they could do back in those days, and decides to have a surrogate child to her maidservant. In other words, she would use her to have the child, but the child would be hers. She would take the child and make the child hers, take it away from her servant. Kind of a cruel thing to do, really. But they did those things back then, you know. And so this is what she did. So she tells Jacob, well, you know, give me a child. And she bugs him. I guess she must have been bugging him daily. Give me a child. And the scripture says Jacob got mad. He just got angry. He got upset. He said, am I God? I can't open up your womb. You know. And so she says, well, I can't let Leah, you know, have this kind of prestige with Jacob because I'll begin to lose my, you know, having a child meant a lot back in those days. It meant an awful lot. So what she does, she gets her servant, her maid servant, and gives her to Jacob and says, you can have a child by her and I will have a child through her. And Jacob, being the carnal man that he was, remember the situation back with Abraham. You know, he probably said in his mind, well, Lord, you know, I got to live with these women and you know, I got to keep down the stress level here. I'll go ahead and give her a child through, you know, and no doubt, what was her name, Bilhah, or whatever her name was, she probably was very attractive too as well. Wasn't too hard for him to go do that. And he did, had a child. Well, this went on back and forth like this. It got to the point where Leah even got downright a mercenary about it, even bought Jacob one night. It just really got ridiculous. It was the mandrakes, they called it, but the Hebrew word is a different word, actually. But it was a particular fruit that it appears was a some form of a fertility fruit. And Rachel wanted this fruit because she was infertile. And Leah was taking this fruit. Her son was bringing it. So she said, you know, you can, you know, give me the fruit and you can have Jacob tonight if you give me the fruit. That's an amazing story. But, you know, that's one of the things about the Bible. It's very honest with the humanness of the people that even God dealt with. It's very honest about it. Doesn't try to hide it. Because there are lessons there that God wants us to see. So she hires him. And Leah goes and she has Jacob for the night. And she gets pregnant again and she has another couple more children. All in all, I think she has 6 or 7 children by Jacob. But then when she stopped bearing children, she started using her handmaidens for Jacob to have children through. So you had both of them, they're using their maids. They're competing. You know, I had a different name for it. I called it the Battle of the Conceptions. The Battle of the Conceptions that began to take place there. All in all, they ended up having 11 sons this way and one daughter named Dinah. So I'm skipping a lot of territory. I'm giving the summary of it in this chapter. Later on, of course, there was one more son added, Benjamin, and that was at the time that Rachel died, when she gave birth to Benjamin. But that's a few chapters ahead. What I thought I would do at this point is go into the names of each one of the sons that were born to them. Because I believe that God gave these names prophetically through Jacob and the wives of Jacob to these children, to picture prophetically what he would do through Israel in sending the promised seed. Now, a couple of the names I have a little bit of difficulty, I admit, fitting into that concept. But most of the other names seem to fit that concept. There are some who feel the names were meant to identify each tribe as far as the characteristic. I don't see that. That may be true, but I didn't see it, so if someone can show me how, I'm willing to listen to it. But as I went through it, instead of it identifying each tribe as far as the characteristic, to me, it identified the characteristics of the Messiah, of Jesus Christ, each one of these names. So what I did is wrote down the names, and I'll go through each one of them, just skip all the, and she begat, and, you know, and Leah conceived, and then Bilhah conceived, and then, you know, Zilpha conceived. And so I would skip all that and just jump to after they had all been born and what their names were. Reuben was the firstborn, and his name meant simply, "Behold a son." Behold a son. And I believe that that certainly is relating, and it could possibly even be translated, possibly. And I'm throwing, this is me throwing this in there, so don't take this as being the absolute gospel, but could possibly be translated, "Behold the son." I believe that might possibly be the real implication here, but again, that's me throwing my own speculation in that regard. But behold a son. And I believe that's referring, of course, to Jesus Christ. Behold a son. Because what characteristic would that relate to Reuben? How would that relate a characteristic to identify the tribe? How they're a son? You're supposed to see a son about them some kind of way? It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Behold a son. And then the next son was Simeon, which meant herd. Herd. Now, when I look at this, I started thinking of scriptures in the New Testament when it talks about when Christ first came forth, just before his baptism, and John the Baptist is there, and said, "Behold the Lamb of God." And then when God's Holy Spirit comes down upon him after baptism, he says, "Behold, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." The scriptures like that started coming into mind as I was looking at this. And then it says, herd. Simeon just simply means herd. And I thought about in Hebrews where it says, he was heard in that he feared, speaking in terms of Christ. He was heard in that he feared. Then there was another incident where Christ was about to heal, bring forth Lazarus. And he said a prayer. And he said, "Father, I don't pray this for myself." And he says, "So that they know you always hear me." I think it was relating to Christ and how he was always heard of the Father. Then Levi was the other next son that was born. His name just simply meant joined to. And I immediately thought about where Christ said, "I and my Father are one." I and my Father are one. Other scriptures where Christ said, talked about the Father works in me and does the works. They were joined of the same kind, same spirit. Judah simply means praise. Praise. And I immediately thought about how when Christ was coming into Jerusalem just before his crucifixion, and the children had the palm trees praying, and Christ made this statement about if they didn't do this, the stones would cry out and praise him. Remember that? So I thought about that and how this relates to praise toward the Messiah. And then the next one is Dan. Dan, which simply means judge. And the scripture makes it quite clear that the one who is given all judgment is Christ. Even the Father does not judge. You realize the Father is doing no judging? That all judgment has been given to Christ to judge? All of that has been given to him. Now the next one is much more difficult. I'm not quite sure how to put this one. And it's Naphtali. And Naphtali just simply means wrestling. Wrestling. I thought about the possibility of how this might apply, but I'm not sure really. So you may come up with something that might be much better. But the thing that I thought about, how it talks about Christ with strong tears and crying and seeking God to save him, and how he had to go through this great wrestling within the flesh. So I thought it could possibly be dealing with Christ having to overcome in the flesh. Maybe dealing with that. The next one is Gad, which means troop. That's all it says, troop. Well, we know that Christ was the Lord of hosts before he became incarnated in the flesh. And we know he's coming again, it says, with his hosts. He is the Lord of hosts that has a troop, and that's all a troop means, or an army. And he certainly has that, there's no doubt about it. The next one is Asher, and that tribe's name just simply means joyful. Joyful. And I immediately thought about Christ's reward when he says, when he was talking about rewarding the saints at the time he come, he says, "Enter thou into the joy of the Lord." And Paul also speaks about the joy of salvation, which salvation is in Christ. The joy of salvation. As I thought about that. The next one is Issachar. And this one, even easier yet to relate to Christ. Issachar. And it just simply means there is recompense, or there is reward. There is reward. And that one was easy too. I thought about it immediately what Christ said. His reward is with him. He is coming to reward the saints, he says. And his reward is with him. And I thought about that. And then the next one is Zebulun. Zebulun. And it means exalted. Exalted. And what does the scripture say? Christ has been exalted on the right hand of the Father, with all thrones, principalities, and powers being subject unto him, and the very angels of God worshiping him and exalting him. He is exalted. And then the next one is Joseph. Joseph. And this one actually has the name of God in the name Joseph. It goes like this. Jehovah has added. And that made a lot of sense. Because what now is Christ doing? Adding to the family of God. Adding through the church. He came to build the church, remember? He came to build the church. Said, "I shall build my church. Gates of hell shall not prevail against it." And that's what he's doing. He's adding now. He is the Son, the firstborn Son, and now he is adding to his church and to the family of God. And the last one, Benjamin, even though we haven't got to that name yet in Scripture, but in a couple of chapters later, Rachel has him. And she dies when she has him. She tries to give him a different name, by the way, Ben-Ami or something like that. And Jacob, inspired prophetic spirit, changes the name immediately, instantly, at the time of her death, and names him Benjamin instead of Ben-Ami, which is what she was trying to name him. And it was a name that meant something about bitter or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't that nice. But Jacob changes the name instantly, which no doubt was inspired of God for him to do so. And that one is a very interesting name. And it means, let me see, I've lost some place here. Oh, Son of the Right Hand. Son of the Right Hand. Oh, you can see that pretty easy, can't you? Where is Christ sitting? At the right hand of the Father. Now, you know, the right hand was symbolic of the strength, where your greatest strength was at. Son of the right hand. And who is the Son truly of the right hand, who sits at the right hand of the Father? Jesus Christ. So I believe that all these names, therefore, are given as a prophetic picture of the Messiah, of Jesus Christ himself. Again, if you got a better explanation, I want to hear it. A couple of the words I realize are a little more difficult to understand or explain, but most seem to kind of fit. They seem to fit. But God, of course, was the one involved in the naming of each of the tribes of Israel. And each of those tribes, therefore, their names were to picture God working out his salvation. See why the book of Genesis is so powerful. And you see why even the working through Israel and the way that God did and he established Israel is so powerful. Because God is laying out his way of accomplishing his purpose, his plan, and he's not allowing the human frailties of the individuals involved to stop it. The honor is not to them, really. In one sense it is, but the primary honor, I guess I should say, because there is a certain honor that is there unto the children of Israel, but the primary honor is unto the Savior, unto God himself. That's where the primary honor is. Their honor is in pointing to his honor. That's where their honor comes, in pointing to his honor and to Christ. So God is working out his plan here, even in spite of this ridiculous situation with the battle of the conceptions going on and all of this bickering and fighting that's taking place, that's happening there. God is working out his plan, and he's even by the naming of each of those tribes prophetically pointing to what he is going to accomplish as they are in the midst of their carnality. Just an amazing thing to observe and showing how great our God is, how great and awesome he is. That covers pretty much 29. It does go over into 30 where they start to bargain on buying Jacob and all that kind of stuff. And we go down to the bottom of chapter 30 to another scene that I wanted to deal with to show you how God can take a bad situation that is against us and work it in your favor. See, all these examples that are there with the patriarchs. Because Jacob was being cheated by his uncle. Changed his wages at least 10 times. He worked for him almost a total of 20 years. And he had nothing. And God took the situation and reversed it. Took a bad situation and reversed it to bless Jacob. So let's read a little bit about that now as we go into it. Let's go down to verse 25 in chapter 30. And it came to pass when Rachel had born Joseph that Jacob said unto Laban, "Send me away that I may go into mine own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go. For you know my servant which I have done you." And Laban said unto him, "I pray you, if I have found favor in your eyes, tarry. For I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake." Now here's the guy, really, he's got a problem. Because he knows that God has blessed him because of Jacob. But at the same time, he's cheating the guy. Now he's got a problem. He's got a real problem. Now going on here, and Jacob says unto him, "Appoint me your wages." Laban says, "Appoint me your wages, and I will give it." In other words, you tell me what I owe you, and I'll give it. Well, he had no intention of giving him anything. But he said, "Tell me what you owe me, and I'll give it." And he said unto him, "You know how I've served you, and how your cattle was with me. For it was little which you have before I came, and it is now increased unto a multitude. And the Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now when I shall provide for my own house, how shall I provide for my own house also?" In other words, I don't have anything. But God has blessed you since I've been here. Now I really believe this, brethren. I know it might seem far-fetched to some of you, but I really believe that wherever each one of you may be in this world, that others will be blessed for your sake, to bless you. Seriously. I was telling my wife this, she had a hard time believing me, but You know, she was having a very difficult time at a job, and she knew she needed to be out of that job. She wanted to retire, but, you know, they weren't offering anything at the time. And I know she started praying about it, and I started praying about it too, and I started praying that God would make a way for her to be able to retire out of that job. Well, lo and behold, the state offers a really nice retirement package, early retirement, because the budget of the state was bad. They had to downsize, but they didn't want to lay people off. So they offered a budget package to try to get some of the people that were kind of close to retirement, but not quite there, but offering them full retirement even though they weren't in retirement age. So I told Doris, I said, well, there it is. God has answered your prayer. So she said, well, you think God actually moved the whole state? I said, yeah. Yeah, I do. Because I had him move the state of Michigan for me to give me a job. I know. And put me in a position on near the 14th floor in Lansing with all these top administrators, and I didn't even have a degree. So I believed it. I said, yeah, I do. So there are other people blessed in that process, right? Because a lot of other people were retired too that wanted to get out of there. But it was for Doris that it was happening. Now, I know she had a hard time believing that, but I did not have a hard time believing it. It made all the sense in the world to me. You know why? Because, see, I knew it was in the air. I knew how God worked, how He does things. And there are many other examples in God's Word. Look at Daniel. You know, this young Hebrew boy, about 14, 15, whatever it was. Don't know the exact age, but there's strong indications he was just a teenager when he was taken captive. Now, he was taken captive. Now, think about this for a moment, brethren. He was a captive. The enemy came in, destroyed the city, and took them as slaves. Now, think about that for a moment. And this young boy, God uses him to bring a word to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the empire, the emperor, if you will, and he becomes second in command over the entire nation. And he was still just a young boy yet. Second in command over the entire nation, given enormous power. Can God do those kinds of things? Yeah, I see it in His Word, so I really believe it. So what did God do? God ended up blessing the nation of Babylon. This is a carnal nation. And they were blessed. And as a result, the other Jewish people that were under that regime were blessed too. Because of what? Why? Because of this one righteous man, Daniel, who belonged to God. So I believe it. I thoroughly believe it, that for those who are God's children, when you walk into a building and you get a job there, that place has just got blessed when you walked in the door. That's right. There, the economics of that company is going to improve. Things are going to go better for them. Or if things go bad, then things will still go good for you, even if it goes bad for them. But more than likely, things are going to go good. Because you're there. And then if it's not going to go good, then it's time God has something else in mind for you. But while you're there, God's going to bless that situation in behalf of you. This is what happened to Jacob. Now this guy tried to cheat him. And God was blessing him. You know, this guy was a crook. But he's still getting blessed. Why? Because God's servant was there. And God was blessing him in behalf of His servant. You know, because God still works through human instruments. Still works through human instruments. And going on here, it says here, where was I? Verse 31. Verse 32, and I will pass through all your flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted cattle and all the brown. So this is a deal. Here's Jacob's deal. Here's Jacob's deal. Summarizing. I'm going to go through and remove from your cattle all of the weak and frail cattle. You know, these are cattle that had markings on them. You've seen animals that I guess we would call them like mongrel-looking animals. You know, they don't look thoroughbred. They're not thoroughbreds, I guess you could say. Not the highest level of breeding. Well, Jacob said, I'm going to go through and I'm going to take the speckled and the brown and the spotted and so forth. And all the other lambs, the ones that are solidly white or solidly black, that are pure thoroughbred, those are yours. All the good ones are yours. And I'll take the bad ones for my wages. Now, you know, you know, Laban, being the greedy guy that he was, he figured, hey, that's a good deal. That's a real good deal. Because the majority out there were all the good animals. It's only a few speckled ones, spotted ones, and other stuff like that. Yeah, I'll let him have those. But see, he was so dishonest. You know what he did? Let's read on. And then he goes on, so shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come, when it should come for my hire before your face. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the sheep, that shall be counted stolen with me. In other words, if I have any that are solid white or solid black and are not speckled or not brown, then you know I stole them. And you take retribution, do what you have to do. If I have any like that among me, then they're yours and I've stolen yours from you. So Laban liked this deal. And Laban said, behold, I would, it shall be according to your word. And he removed that day. Now listen to this. This is Laban did this with his sons. And he removed that day the goats that were ring-streaked and spotted, and all the sheep goats that were speckled and spotted, and everyone that had some white in it, and all the brown among the sheep, and gave them into the hands of his sons. You see what this guy did? So he runs out saying, he's not getting none. So I'm going to, take all. I'm taking all the solid colored ones, and I'm taking the speckled and the brown ones too. I'm getting all those too. And he went out and got them. And Jacob would still be taking care of his sheep, right? And he got every one of them. And he set 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. In other words, he separated. Jacob still had to take care of all his other, the solid colored sheep. But he separated them by 3 days' journey. So Jacob wouldn't know about all where these other sheep were. And he couldn't come get them. So he separated them. And verse 37, Jacob took him rods of green poplar. Now this is something I have to confess I don't really understand. My guess on this was done for symbolic purposes. But whatever it is, he did it. He took these tree rods and what have you, of different colors. A green poplar and of hazel and chestnut tree, and peeled white streaks in them and made the white appear which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had peeled before the flocks in the gutters in the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to the drink. Now this was something God actually told him to do. God told Jacob to do this, as you'll see later on. But he took these here twigs and these branches of different colors and types and put them in the water trough. Now, I've heard some people say, some of your commentators really just gave some wild stuff. They said the animal's imagination was affected and, caused them to have different colored, the sheep and what have you. I don't think I buy that one. I don't buy that one. Could it have been some chemical reaction that this stuff had in the water that can make a change? That's a possibility, but I personally believe it was just simply God performed a miracle and had Jacob go through a ritual of putting this out there, because God does these little rituals from time to time in order to get them to do things. It's sort of like when Naaman was at leprosy and he came to Elisha for healing, Elisha told him to go to the Jordan River and dip in this here dirty, muddy river 7 times. Did the river heal Naaman? No. But it was a symbolic act. It was a symbolic act. And he was made clean. And all the leprosy left him. Well, I believe the same thing with this here ritual that Jacob went through with these here twigs and branches and stuff that he put in the troughs. And then God caused the flock, this is the good flock now, Laban's flock, come over to drink out of it. And every one of them that came over and drank in front of this stuff, they would also at the same time conceive as they were drinking. Right at that trough. And these were the best of the animals that Laban had. To make a long story short, in a short period of time, almost virtually all the flock became speckled, brown, and streaked. And hardly any of the flock left with solid color. All speckled brown and streaked. Now that may have some symbolic meaning there that I have not yet figured out. I thought about that, but I haven't got to it yet. Why was all the flock speckled brown and streaked? And all had the appearance of being flawed, but they really weren't flawed. And God was the one making the choice. Oh, that does kind of make sense, doesn't it? So it comes to me right now. We start talking about sheep, right? And talk about God's calling and how he calls us out of the world and so forth. And God is the one that calls, and he calls the weak of the world and the base. And the, oh, yeah, it does make sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. See, like I said, the whole book of Genesis, this is what we're seeing, is the gospel being preached and how God has done. Yeah, it makes sense. I hadn't thought about it. Yeah. See, there you guys helped me come to that one. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And so God does this, and they all speckle and brown now, and all of a sudden Laban wakes up one morning, finds out he hardly has no sheep left. All of the sheep have turned speckle and brown, and what could you say? Because this deal has been made. This contract has been signed. He could say nothing. And God actually turned the riches of Laban over to Jacob in that way. An enormous thing that took place here. Let's go down. Verse 41. And it came to pass, whensoever the stronger cattle did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before the eyes of the cattle in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the cattle were feeble, he put them not in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger ended up being Jacob's. And the man increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses or donkeys. So God transferred the wealth of Laban over to Jacob. And God would do the same for any one of us if need be. He will provide what we need when it is his purpose and his time. He will provide it. Now, sometimes he will let us go and suffer long, because Jacob suffered for 20 years. 20 years, 20 long years before this happened. He had some lessons to learn. But in the end, God blessed him and blessed him powerfully with this wealth. And he heard the words of Laban, verse 1, chapter 31, he heard the words of Laban's son saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's had he gotten all this glory. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as before. And the Lord said to Jacob, return unto the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. You see this repeated so often as we read about the patriarchs. God says this over and over. I will be with you. I will bless you. I will multiply you. Constantly says this over and over. In verse 4, Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field unto his flock, and said unto them, I see your father's countenance that is not friendly toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my power I have served your father, and your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. And I've experienced that too. I've actually had an employer who purposely and willfully on a day-to-day basis attempted to hurt me. Every day I came in, this guy tried to devise some new way to try to completely discombobulate me. And God actually took the situation and turned it to my blessing. And that guy actually ended up getting run out of town. I think I mentioned it to you before. He got ran out of town. Came by my house to let me know he was leaving town. And he was running scared for his life. He even had a shotgun in the back of his trunk because he thought someone was going to try to shoot him. Left town. Never came back. Never saw him again. So God will do these kinds of things. He says, if he said, thus the speckle shall be your wages, then all the cattle bear speckle. And if he said, thus the ring streaked shall be your hire, then bear all the cattle ring streaked. Thus God has taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. And it came to pass at the time that the cattle conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream. And behold, the rams which leaped upon the cattle were ring streaked, speckled, and grizzled. And the angel of God spake unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob? And I said, Here I am. And he said, Lift up now your eyes and see all the rams which leap upon the cattle are ring-streaked, speckled and grizzled. For I have seen all that Laban doth unto thee. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you vowed a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return into the land of their kindred. Showing you also that God has honored Jacob's having anointed that pillar, that stone. That's why I believe that stone is the stone that's in England. I believe it really is. And why? Because God himself honored it. So the stone of Scone, or it's also called the stone of destiny, that is in Scotland now. That stone was anointed by Jacob, so I believe that it is. Why? Because God himself honored it. And he said, and Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, Is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not counted to him as strangers? For he has sold us and has quite devoured also our money. So the dowry that Jacob was working for to pay for his wives, Laban took that. See, the brides are supposed to have a dowry too. You know, they get an inheritance also. A certain amount of money and wealth that the brides are supposed to get to be taken with them. But he said, he's taking our money too. So, you know, here's what they said. We are counted of him as strangers, for he has sold us and has quite devoured also our money. For all the riches which God has taken from our father, that is ours and our children's. Now then, whatsoever God has said unto you, do. Then Jacob rose up and set his son and his wives upon camels. And his pride now has come into the situation. He's made this deal. He can't really back out of it. But at the same time, he just can't let him take that wealth with him like that. He just can't do it. So he gets together his servants like a little army, and he goes after Jacob, and he intends to do harm. He intends to violently take back the wealth that Jacob took, along with his daughters. He's going to take it all. What happens? It says here, and verse 24. And God came to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said unto him, Take heed that you speak not to Jacob, neither good or bad. In other words, don't you go in and try to speak good to take advantage of him. And don't you do anything, say anything bad to take advantage of him. Now that doesn't leave a whole lot for Laban to have to be able to say. Doesn't leave a whole lot. Then it says here, Then Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mount of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, Why, what have you done that you have stolen away unawares to me and carried away my daughters as captives with the sword? Now, you know, I looked at this and I said, this guy didn't listen to God too well, because he's already saying some stuff he don't have any business saying. Wherefore did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and did not tell me that I might have sent you away with mirth and with songs? With the tabret and with the harp. I would have had a party for you. Sure. Sure he would have. And has not suffered me to kiss my sons and my daughters. You have now done foolishly in so doing. It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. Then he thought. He said, But the God of your father spake unto me last night, saying, Take thou heed that you speak not to Jacob, either good or bad. He reminded himself, Oh, wait a minute. Let me step back. He remembered. And now, though thou wast needs be gone because you sore long after your father's house, yet wherefore have you stolen my gods? Now, what happened, to make a long story short, his daughter Rachel took these gods. They were like family gods, like sort of like talisman or something like that, that protect the family. Now, Rachel was smart, really. She didn't take these gods because she was worshiping these gods. She knew that her father trusted in these gods. And she took these gods so he would have nothing to trust in his pursuit of them. It was really a smart move on the part of Rachel. Give them the psychological edge, because she knew how much her father trusted in these little idols, these little gods. So now here he is without his God, and the true God has spoke to him the night before, saying, don't touch Jacob. He's in dire straits. He's in dire straits. Well, to make a long story short, he doesn't find the gods, and he and Jacob make a covenant that, we won't go past this particular landmark. They set up a bunch of pillars, and they give it a name, and it's called Stone of Witness or something like that, and you stay on that side, you don't come on my side, and I don't come on your side, and we won't bother each other no more. So he went ahead and left, went back the next morning. And from that point on, Jacob had no more trouble with Laban. Now we come to chapter 32. So Jacob went on his way after that, and look what God does in verse 1. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. That's another thing about God that is such a wonderful thing. And as you live this life, you experience it more and more. You go through various trials. You have difficulties. You struggle through. You hang on. God delivers, and then he encourages you at that point to go on further. Because Jacob has another trial coming up here. Now, he just dealt with Laban, and now he's got to deal with his brother Esau. It was 20 years ago. He doesn't know what his state of mind is today. He doesn't know if that grudge has grown all those years. And Jacob knows his brother Esau was a warrior. That guy was a tough dude. And he has an army. And Jacob's afraid of him, too. He knows this guy could come in here and he could wipe us out. He's really concerned about it. But God has angels meet him, met Jacob on the way to encourage him so that he could face this next trial that he's about to face. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's host. And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Mahanaim. And it meant something about God in camps, or the hosts in camps, or something like that. I thought about this psalm in Psalm 34, where it talks about the angels of the Lord encampeth about the righteous. Probably where they got it from this right here, where David got that from. And I believe that's true. When David wrote that, he knew that God did this for the righteous. See, what you read about here at Jacob, as you read through it, put yourself in that situation, because, see, God has called you and you belong to him. And because you are one of God's children, the very exact same thing that God did for Jacob, he does for us today. Same thing. What did Christ say? He said that be careful about offending one of these little ones, because their angels behold the face of God. Didn't he say that? Well, when he was talking about little ones, he wasn't talking about just little children physically. He was talking about the children of God in the church. They're angels, he said. So that means that, you know, we got at least one. I probably got a bunch of them. I need a bunch of them. It's too easy for me to get in trouble. So God said, I got to send a troop down here for this guy. But we got them. That's right. Every one of us. Just like Jacob. And these angels met him. And as I mentioned, I think last week, we don't know how many of them are sitting up in here right now. All around us. If God was to open up our eyes where we could see them, we'd probably see them all about us. Up in the ceiling, on the walls, you know, wherever. All about us. They're there. And we need the protection and help that God gives us with them. Goes on, it says, and Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, into the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau. Thy servant Jacob says, thus I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now, and I have oxen and asses and flocks and men servants and women servants. In other words, you don't have to worry about me taking no inheritance from you. I've got my own stuff. So don't worry, Esau. I'm not coming back to take anything from you. I got my own stuff. Verse 6, and the messengers returned, Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and also he comes to meet you, and 400 men with them. And Jacob's heart probably dropped to his feet right then and there. Probably dropped right to his feet. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels and the two bands. So he took precautions, which is not wrong to take precautions. You know, you have some people say, well, you know, I trust in the Lord. I trust in the Lord to do this for me, and they won't do a thing for themselves. They say, I trust in the Lord to do this, and they think it's some kind of sin to do anything for yourself. Well, no, it's not. You do what you can do humanly, and God does what we as humans can't do. But we do what we can humanly. And Jacob did that. So he used wisdom. Let me divide up the flock, you know, the flocks, and let me divide my family here, put so many over here, some over there. So if he does, if the Lord allows him to attack them, then I could possibly maybe save these over here. Because I'm not sure even at this point just what the Lord just might allow. You see, his faith still was not yet perfect. So he went ahead and did what he could do. But he also did something else. He prayed. Next verse 9, and Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which has said unto me, return unto your country. In other words, you told me to come here, Lord. And to your kindred, and I will deal with you. I am not worthy the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown unto your servant. God had been dealing with Jacob. He said, I'm not worthy of any of these things you've shown me. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray you, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, unless he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And you said, I will surely do you good, and make your seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. You see how he talked with God? He was honest. Now he was scared. You know, Lord, I'm afraid. Now I know you said these things, but I'll remind you about what you said. You know, I'm reminded by what you said, Lord. Now, I'm trusting you, but I'm also concerned. But he prayed from his heart to God at that point. He probably said a lot more than what's written down here. I have no doubt that he did some hard praying. And he lodged there that same night, and he took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau's brother. So he's still not through doing what he can do. He puts together a present for him now. A big present. And he sent it to Esau. And they get to this river to cross over, possibly Jordan perhaps. And he sends on his family on ahead of him that evening. And they left him alone by himself. He wasn't through praying. He knew that probably the next day Esau was going to show up. And he was still concerned. And Jacob knew he needed to spend time alone communing with God. And he probably had set himself to commune with God all night long. There are times in your life you might have to do something like that. I've had to do that before. There are times in your life, in order to get over certain things in this life, you may have to set yourself a time to fast and pray and seek God all night long. And you know what? If you really, if the desire is there, it's not as hard as you think. It really is. I've done it. If that urge and that urgency and that sense of awareness and need is very powerful with you, you can do it. And you will do it. Well, you will go to God and you will begin to speak with him that evening, and when you finally come to yourself, you look up and it's 5 o'clock in the morning. And you would have prayed all night long. And I guarantee you do that, results happen. When God sees one of his children seek him that way, it impresses him. It really does. Because it's not something that we normally do. It's something really out of the norm for a human fleshly creature to do that. Especially someone you can't even see with your eyes. And you're talking to them all night long. And Jacob had already committed himself to do this. That's why he sent them on. He knew that he was going to be praying all that night. And he wanted to be alone, to cry out his heart, to pour out his heart, and to commune with God. He knew that it was absolutely essential that he do this. And he did. But he didn't know what was going to happen, though, next. He didn't know this was going to happen. So he took his wives and sent them over. And it says here in verse 21, and he was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. So when he began to pray, somebody showed up. And whoever it was, I'll let you figure out who it really was, but whoever it was, he knew, and how he knew, I don't know, but he knew that this person was really divine. A messenger from God. Even though looking like a man, there was something unusual about this person, and Jacob knew it. And you know what he did? He was so earnest in his prayer to seek God that evening to begin with, and so desperate to be completely reassured of God's presence with him, that he jumped and grabbed him. And in my mind, I can picture Jacob not even hesitating. He jumped and grabbed him. When this guy showed up, he just jumped and grabbed him. And then the guy probably said, "Let me go." And he said, "No, I won't." Now that was determination. And that was also a certain amount of courage too, you know. Because he knew this person that he grabbed was divine, was holy, but he grabbed him. And the person said, "Well, let me go." He said, "No, I won't until you bless me. I need reassurance. I need to know you're with me. I need to know that all this stuff that my grandfather would talked about and that my father talked about, that all that stuff is true. I need reassurance. I'm facing a tough situation tomorrow. And I need to know that you truly are going to be with me and I'm not letting you go." And so they begin to wrestle in the dust all night long. Now, of course, you know this being could have easily, you know, took his thumb and flipped him over to the other side of the earth. But see, God was testing Jacob too as well. He was testing him like he does all of us. He tests us sometimes to see how truly, diligently, and earnestly we desire his will and him in our lives. How much do we want him in our lives? And sometimes God tests us. He'll let you go through trials like unemployment. He'll let you go through various other trials that you'll meet and see how earnest will you be to seek his will then. You know, it's easy for us to say that we love God or we're committed to him and everything's going okay. It's easy to do that. But how much do we really know God? How much do we really want him in our lives? How much do we really want to know him? What price are we willing to pay? And God, sometimes, he wants to know that. What price are we willing to pay? How much of a worth is he to us? How much, how much time are we willing to give? How much pain are we willing to suffer? And that's a hard one right there. Because sometimes in order to really, and in fact, I don't know, maybe it's all the time, in order to take that next level with God, that profound defining moment and level of closeness to him, sometimes it takes some pain to cross that barrier. Human nature has to go through this here pain. The selfishness and all the self-centeredness and all the other stuff that's there has to be overcome. And it's not done without discomfort and difficulty. But Jacob wrestled. And this was some kind of wrestling match. This was the wrestling match of the ages. In fact, a wrestling match that probably determined things for the ages. It's that kind of a wrestling match. It says here, he wrestled with him until the breaking of day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, this angel or this divine being or whoever this was, he could not get him to stop. So what he did, it says here, he touched the hollow of his thigh. I'm not sure where that was. Now, some commentators say it was the hip. I think there's some place up here, even in the King James here, it says hip. But when you look in the Hebrew, it doesn't use the word hip at all. So I don't know. Others say that it was the groin area in the thigh, that he actually caused the muscle to literally pop, the sinew to literally pop. You know, if you've ever had hamstring, which I've had. Those things hurt. And one of those things pop and you can go down instantly. You can't stand back up. So it could have been one of those. But he caused either muscle or sinew, either in the thigh muscle or it could have been the hip. I don't know which one. Could have been the hip muscle where it popped the socket. Well, if it did something like that, I don't see how he could have stood that. I don't know how he could have held on to anything with something like that happening. But whatever it was painful. It was painful. And it crippled him where he couldn't stand up. But Jacob had a hold of this man and would not let go. Even in the midst of pain, he wanted so desperately to have God close by and in his life at that point that the pain he was willing to bear, and he held on, would not let go. Every time I read this, I say, wow, what incredible determination. Because I probably would have let go the minute the thing popped. I probably would, ow, you know. Just like that, I would have let go, you know. But he didn't. He held on and wouldn't let go. So then, after this being did this, and it says his thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him, and he said, let me go for the day breaks. You know, the daytime is coming. I don't want anyone to see me. And he said, I will not let you go except you bless me. Now, that, I mean, unbelievable. And he said to them, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And here's what he says to Jacob. Here's his blessing to Jacob. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment. He said, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, Israel. For as a prince have you power with God and with men, and have prevailed. Meaning, you have prevailed with God in your determination. So God will be with you from now on, and you shall prevail from now on with man. You will have the advantage in every way. That's my promise to you. And brother, that is what God has called all of us to do, is to prevail. We have to prevail over our own flesh. We have to prevail over this society. We have to prevail even with God. How do we do that? The same way Jacob did. He went there that night to pray and to supplicate and to seek God with all of his whole heart until he got an answer. Now, in his particular case, he wrestled also with a divine being. I personally believe it was Jesus Christ that he wrestled with. That's who he wrestled with. And we have to wrestle with God also. We have to persevere in seeking God today. We have to do the same thing. And those times when you feel far away from God, brethren, that should be a signal to all of us. That is the time in which we need to really put forth a concerted effort to persevere, to seek him with all our whole heart. In prayer, in meditation, his word, and fasting. You may need to take off from your job if you're working for a day or two. And sometimes, you know, if you can't take off, God might make sure you can take off. He'll do that. I've had that happen too. He'll make sure you have time so that you can seek him and seek him diligently with all your whole heart. This was a defining moment for Jacob. In fact, so much so it changed him. It wasn't just his name that changed. At that moment when this happened with Jacob, his character changed. Jacob was a completely converted man. Now, whatever degree of conversion he had before, I don't know. But I know at this point in time, that conversion, if he was already converted, took a much more profound level at this point. If he was not converted, he surely was converted after this. Completely. He changed. Let's read it and see. And he said, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. He said, after this, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, which means to prevail with God. And then verse 29, and Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray you, your name. And he said, wherefore or why are you asking me my name? And he blessed him there. He blessed him. So it was not only what he blessed him in respect to his change of name and his prevailing with man from that point on, but it seems some additional blessing as well was given. at this point in time. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, which actually means face to face with God. That's what it means. Face to face with God. So Jacob seemed to believe and was convicted that he actually had wrestled with God himself. Jacob believed that. And since God has left this written this way, then I have to believe it too. So this was no ordinary angel. This was God himself that wrestled with him in the form of a man, but that wrestled with him. He said, "For I've seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose up upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. So God didn't even heal him. He left him with this reminder of what he had gone through. That reminder was there. So he probably had to get himself a stick or a cane the next morning. He could barely walk. And when his family saw him, here he was, halting upon one leg. And I get the feeling, I'm not sure, this is just my own speculation, I get the feeling that this remained with Jacob for the remainder of his life. Why do I say that? Well, here's what it says. "Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew that shrank." It appears that this is something that stayed with Jacob the rest of his life. And the children of Israel's sons, grandsons, they all saw this effect on Jacob. This, you know, his halt, and the story was continually told as to how he got that way. And so it became a thing back in those days. They did that kind of stuff. When they honored a patriarch in some special way, they would do certain special things as an honor. I think of the sons of Zadok, who, I can't remember now, but it was a particular thing that they would not do in honor to their father. It wasn't a sin if they had done it, but they wouldn't do it. And God actually took note of their honoring that father their way as an example. And so therefore he determined he was going to honor their descendants because of the way they honored their father. And this is what the children of Israel did. They honored Jacob from that time forward. So when they would get the thigh bone of a calf or a lamb, they would not eat that part where the sinew shrank, wherever that was. Again, I don't know if it was the hip. I don't know if it was the groin area of the thigh. I don't know where it was at. But whatever part it was, they knew. And they wouldn't eat it. So I'm inclined to believe that Jacob had that reminder for the rest of his life. It was a defining moment. And from that time on, Jacob, you don't see Jacob doubting anymore after that. You don't see it as we read through the rest of the story of Jacob. That doubt is no longer there. He knows now who his God is. He has been with him face to face. He understands what his destiny is. And he moves on from there. It's a defining moment. And each one of us are destined, if you have not had it yet, we're all destined to have a defining moment with God. Every one of us will have that. God will bring you to it before you leave this world. You'll have it. It might be at the time that you are leaving it, I don't know. But at some point, he will bring you to that defining moment with him. And you'll know truly who he is. So like what Jacob said, Job. He said, "I've heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." He didn't mean his physical eye. He meant he really saw God for who he was, what he was like. And God intends to bring each and every one of us to that same place, just like Jacob. So at that, I think we can stop on that note and leave it at that. And we got some more stuff to cover. We're a little over half. We're a little over halfway through the book of Genesis. Genesis goes up to chapter 50, so we're at chapter 33 now. So what is that, about 17 more chapters to go? So we're getting there. And I'm hoping that maybe within the next month we can kind of move a little more rapidly through some things. And then we'll probably go through a New Testament book after that. I think it would be a good idea to relate some things dealing with Christ and his ministry as we head toward Passover at the beginning of the year and go into that. Wanted to mention one last thing. Remember the time of year that we're living in. You know what I mean. I wanted to pull it down, but I said, I can't do it. But, you know, but the Christmas season. Don't let yourself get caught up in it, because we've been given something that is far, far greater. Far greater. What they're doing in respect to Christmas, honestly, brethren, when you read to what God is doing and working out His plan, how can any of this compare? How can any of that compare? It just can't. It's so shallow. Don't allow yourself to get caught up in the spirit of longing for that, or, and I understand, because those early years when I first came to church, you know, it was that little bit of battle you go through. But you know what? I'd say what happens to me now when this time of year comes, it's aggravating. It's aggravating to me. I'm not listening to my radio right now because I don't want to hear any Christmas songs. So sometimes I might turn on the jazz station, you know, but I have to stop listening to them now because they just started that stuff. Every other song is a Christmas song. So I said, well, okay, until after the holidays, I'm not listening anymore. I don't want to hear that stuff. And just try to keep as much of that stuff out of your head. And look at what God did. I was talking to the doors the other day. I said, you know, they missed the whole point. They're talking about the birth of Christ. What do we celebrate, brother? What do we celebrate? We celebrate what? The death of Christ. Why? Where is the great miracle? Was the great miracle in His being a little baby? No, not really. I mean, in a way, yes, but not quite the way they understand it. What was the miracle of His being a baby to begin with? What was the miracle involved? Something more awesome than that they don't even stop to think about. The fact that He was mortal and could die. He was mortal, flesh and blood, completely and totally. That was the miracle. And He came to die. And God wanted the emphasis to be on His death, because He was already alive to begin with. The fact that God could die. You see, they don't even believe that. They really don't believe God died. They don't even know they don't believe that. They think they believe that God died. But no, if you put it in terms of God dying, they will say, no, God didn't die. Jesus Christ died, the Son of God died. And then you say, oh, He did? Where was He when He was dead? Oh, He was down there in hell preaching to the angels. Wait a minute, I thought you said He was dead. Well, yeah, He was. His body was dead. You see what I'm saying? They don't really believe that He was dead. They don't understand the incarnation of the one who wrestled with Jacob. The one who was Melchizedek. They don't understand who He really was. They don't understand the nature of the Godhead. We have been given, by God's grace, and this enormous privilege of understanding that information, of knowing who He is. We've had a defining moment already. We'll have more of them. But we've had one already. We know who He is and what He came to do. So don't get caught up in that stuff. It's so ridiculous. And I just want to just shout to the top of my voice sometimes and just tell people, don't you know what you're doing? But they don't know what they're doing. They don't understand. But your eyes have been opened. And your eyes see. Don't let your eyes be blinded. Don't long. Don't be like Lot's wife. Turning back and looking back. I don't even want to turn back and look at it. Turn back and looking back at the things of the world. Don't let yourself do that. Think about what we study today, what we have been studying, and the wonderful revelation that God is revealing. You know, what He's doing and how He's doing it. And He's given you the privilege of it. Your eyes are open, but He hasn't opened eyes to the rest of the world. You're among a handful of people in the whole world. It might not even be 200 of us in the Detroit area. I was thinking about that today. And I really kind of doubt there is. Even though there might be 500 in name, but actual converted, may not even be 200. May not even be 150. Might not be 100. It might not be 75. Yes, Larry.
on the way down, on the radio, one of the, I don't know, radio, national radio announcement that said that I think in California that they would not allow the school district teachers to utter the word Christmas. Just, you know, and it was amusing to me because of the fact that this same school was having, playing out the Muslim rituals and whatnot, but you know they weren't allowing them to utter the word Christmas. Like the kids could, but the way the announcer is like, you know, they're taking Christ out of the school so dramatically, but the nation has deceived itself so much now that it doesn't know actually, like you said, who Christ is and what symbolizes Christ. So it's
amazing.
It's rather depressing to hear all that.
It's very depressing because you know there are a lot of very sincere people, really very sincere people, genuine to the extent that they can be. They really believe that they know Christ. They even have these signs saying "Know the Lord." And they really have a genuine motivation as far as what their human limitations will allow them. And they're sincere. And it really is a sad thing to see that. You see that sincerity, and yet they don't know the Lord. And the high day for them of the year is now. This is their high day that's coming up, Christmas. Yes.
Questions. I'd like to see if anyone here can find out, because I often wonder who are these people that are coming up with these laws that says we don't want Christ in the school. Because I can't think of anybody that ran for the Senate or anyone in government that could be an atheist. So if nobody's in government, I mean, at least we know our two people that's in Congress are for God. I guess the question is who are these sneaky people that's coming up? Can you know who is? You know, I like to know their name. Why don't they put their name out in front and says, "Look, this is a document that says, do not go to church. I mean, do not bring church into the school." I like to know who these people are.
Most of the people that you hear, almost the majority of your politicians have this here unfortunate concept of they interpret the Constitution. The article dealing with separation of church and state, they interpret it, unfortunately, in a wrong manner. And so you've had people starting all the way back with Madeleine O'Hare, whatever her name was, and the ACLU, those two organizations and other atheistic organizations and other religions, such as your Islamic faith and other, even the Jews, in fact, as well, who have gotten, in fact, the ACLU, a lot of them are Jews, to be quite frank, to be honest about it, have gotten caught up in this thing of trying to maintain a separation of church and state, which the founding fathers never had any inclination whatsoever for the church to be separated in the sense of expression of faith. Where the separation of church and state involved was in the state controlling religion. But we have today this here false interpretation of the Constitution as a result of people like your atheists and ACLU and other liberal wings of Congress. By the way, you mentioned the congressman here. Your congressman here, by the way, like Conyers and some others, therefore that concept of separation of church and state as it is today. You can write them if you wish and ask them, and I'm sure if they're honest, they'll tell you. They'll tell you. But quite a few of them now go along those lines. Republican and Democrat, to be quite frank. There are a lot of Republicans as well that have this thing about separation of church and state and a wrong concept as to what the founding fathers actually intended. But the founding fathers had religion involved in all of their approaches to government. But they believed profoundly because of what they saw with the dominance of the Catholic Church, with the governments. And then later on, when the governments tried to control the church and this battle was going back and forth, they believed very strongly there had to be a separation of church very distinctly from the state, where they weren't intermixed in the sense of administratively. And that's what it was all about. But today, that's not understood. Today, we have revisionist thinking on just about everything. And that's because you have a society that, to be quite blunt, is lazy. They don't want to study, read, think, and they're not doing that. Nobody wants to think. We have a society that nobody wants to think today. They want someone else to do their thinking for them. And so therefore, you don't have a situation like I was privileged to grow up in. They don't do this much in school anymore. But I was privileged to grow up when they taught this stuff in school. We were taught it. We had to learn the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and give speeches on it. And we learned this stuff in school when I was a kid. But today, these kids don't know anything about that stuff. So whatever they're told, they just accept. That's the world we live in today. And it's not only with that, but with a whole lot of other false stuff. That's the kind of world we live in. Go ahead. That's why God got to come back real soon, because I think we're getting to the point, you know, it's going to be hard to call people because people, their minds are becoming mush, and after a while you won't even be able to call anybody.
Isn't part of it due to the communist infiltration of our educational system?
Yes, socialism.
As well as our entertainment and every aspect of our society taking it over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In all those areas, there's been a great deal of socialistic philosophy and thinking that has come into play. Great deal. Yes.
I just wanted to relate a couple of experiences I've had since I went back to work after my leg incident. I have to check a lot of people out when they leave the building and check in their purse and make sure that they're not taking any merchandise out with them. And I see quite a few of them with Bibles. So I work up in front, or have worked up in front, where they just put up an 8-foot Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. So I have to look at it 8 hours a day. So when these people walk out and I see a Bible in their hand, I said, "You want to understand what that's all about there?"
Yeah.
She said, "What?" I said, "That tree. Read Jeremiah 10, 2 and 4, or through 4. And one girl came back and I asked her, I said, "Did you read?" She said, "Yeah, but a lot of people don't believe it. They think it refers to something else." I said, "I don't know how much clearer it can be. When you tie up a tree or nail down a tree in your house, you decorate it, you're observing it."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in other words, I wanted to relate. I do have, and this is for your benefit too, it gives you a chance to testify in connection with it. When you have that tree in your house, you're violating one of God's promises or one of His commands.
Right. That's true. But you know what? Many of them, they go back to their churches or other places like that, and they do have a particular explanation for that chapter. It's not a good one, but they have one. And one of the major ones they have is that that's not referring to the Christmas tree. That was referring to an idol that they thought was living or alive or something like that, in the form of evergreen tree that would be alive all the time. And that there was an idol that they worshiped. But the tree today is not that today. People are not worshiping it as an idol today. But they have taken it now and put it into Christianity. And what they say is that the evergreen tree, which represents Christ, who's the tree of life, and He said, "I am the vine, and I am the tree," and so forth, and He was connecting me, blah, blah, blah. They use that now. And they say that the orbs that they put on there, you know, which in the past represent the sun, when they put the jewels and the things on the tree, which represents the sun, now they say it represents the Son of God, you know. And so they go through all these different things like that now to dress it up and say that it doesn't fit that anymore. But you have to go to Deuteronomy 12. See, once you start that, you got to go to another scripture, because you got to go to Deuteronomy 12, where God says that He doesn't want to even be associated with any of that stuff in worship, period. If it comes from there, don't even associate it with Me, period. That's what God told the children of Israel. So then you got to go jump to that one, but they're not going to even listen to that one either. But, you know, tell them anyway. Tell them anyway. But chances are they won't, because we live in a world that's blinded. And people don't want to go against the stream. They don't want to swim upstream. They want to go with the flow. And so if you try to make them swim upstream, they get a little violent. They really do. But tell them anyway. You're right. I just wish somebody would ask me. I'm waiting right now. Each day I go to work, I am waiting for someone to ask me. Every day I walk into the office and I just hope somebody asks me. waiting for someone to say Merry Christmas so I can say, I'm sorry, I don't keep Christmas. So I can raise questions because I want to say something because it just drives me nuts. And now they're in my office right now, everybody's decorating, you know, in the office, you know, putting up their reasoning, you know, all that stuff. They're putting up all this stuff around everywhere. You see, my office is just boring and nothing on it, you know. So I know they got to be walking by and they're seeing it. So I'm waiting for somebody to come by and say, aren't you going to decorate your office? I'm hoping, but nobody's asked anything yet. Yes, over here. Was that over?
That's okay.
Yeah, go ahead. That's true. It goes to show our economy is based in idolatry. The economic system is an idolatry system. The Bible refers to our economic system as Babylon. It refers to it as that. So, yeah. So during this time, this is a time to get your head back in the book, back in the Word, and back what God has promised and our hope, and then you'll be able to go through this season without it bothering you. Won't bother, except you'll hate it more. You'll hate it more. So, yes. Yes.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Okay, this is changing the subject right now, but getting back to Jacob and the pole that he laid down.
Yes.
This thought is, he made a cattle guard, and he was doing selective breeding.
Yes. Yes, he was. There's no doubt about it. But I don't know what the poles, though, specifically did.
Have you ever driven over a cattle guard where a lot of cattle are?
No, I haven't. I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, it's iron pipe laid across the road so they don't have a gate.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've never heard of that before.
Oh, yeah, they're all over.
Oh, yeah? So.
If you're around cattle, because, see, they can't, they go back and forth in their trucks and cars.
Uh-huh. No kidding. Wow.
Now, let me tell you, I'm not all that smart. I heard that in the early years in the church, 40 years ago.
So these cattle guards can actually have an effect on the cattle where their breeding can change?
They won't walk over them because they're afraid they'll get their hoof caught. I don't know what they think, but they won't go over them.
Well, what about what Jacob did? So are you saying there could be a correlation between these rods and in some literal way where it caused a change in breeding?
Yeah, some of the cattle on one side of the cattle guard, and then when they come to drink, well, open a place and let the ones in. You know, like if you breed a Siamese cat and a Persian cat, you get a Himalaya.
Oh, I think I understand where you're coming from. So you're saying that these guards, that certain cattle would respond to it a certain way, and the ones who made it would automatically create a particular breed. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Well, that's what the sermon was about 40 years ago, and it made sense to me because I know about cattle guards.
Wow, that's interesting. I'd like to find out more about that. If you're able to get some more information about that, I appreciate it. Yeah, I'd like to hear more about that and get some more definitive stuff about that. That is fascinating. So,
it rung a bell with me, and so that's what I thought.
Mm-hmm. And it could be, you're right, maybe by putting these rods up there, certain particular rods attracted certain particular ones in the cattle.
Well, I don't think so. It's just that when he laid them side by side, and, you know, and made a that instead of a gate, and then he'd let certain ones of the animals in,
oh, so you're saying that certain ones would automatically come past that point and others would not?
I think he directed them, but because he knew that he had come up with a certain breed if he let two mates that it were a certain
type.
Yeah.
Hmm. I want to know more about that.
I'll try to find out more. Well, it was spoken at the feast years and years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they said that was the first cattle guard.
That's fascinating. That's really fascinating. And evidently, I guess God told Jacob what to do.
Right.
So that would happen that way. That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, one thing I know for sure, I don't understand it, but it sure happened.
I may interrupt here, make it a little plainer about a cattle guard. The ones I have seen were pipes and they're laid across a an opening where when the cattle go to get up to it, they see these lines of pipes, but there's openings in between them where they might slip and get their feet caught in them, and I think that's what stops them from going across.
Okay, so you're saying that there's some physical physiology that's involved there. Okay, now I'm really confused. Yeah, I need help on this one. Okay, well, I need some help on that one, but that's it's fascinating, though, what she was talking about, and it seems like some principle of that was involved. It sounds like it was. I'd like to hear more about that. I'd like to hear a lot more about that. Well, I guess we've gone kind of long. It's about 5 minutes to, and I wasn't intending to go quite that long, but I hope it wasn't. I hope it was acceptable. But anyway, we're going to end it now. And we'll have a final song. Larry, lead us in a final song and in prayer. And then we'll have the potluck today. And glad to hear the voices, too, online. It was good to hear you. So, Larry.